Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for their invitation. What I'm going to speak today is a little farther away from the perhaps the main theme of this workshop, but I will be dealing with concrete examples of hyperbolic spaces, namely quotients of bounded symmetric domain and bounded symmetric domains themselves. So the context in which I study would be omega and normally an irreducible bounded symmetric domain. So let me give some example. So this is the P by Q matrices with complex coefficients. I'm of course interested also in their quotients, so also quotients omega mod gamma, where gamma is a lattice of bilomorphisms or bilomorphic automorphisms. Now, so this has rank being the minimum of P and Q. So in the case when the rank is 1, you get simply the following. 1 minus, you get 1 minus z square being positive, and that's the same as saying that you have a ball. So this is, to start with, the kind of domain I'm working on. Okay, and now the topic, so the topic is that of holomorphic isometries. So each one of these domains carries a Bergman metric, which is invariant under the automorphism group. You can also use the K-Lyon time metric, which is the same, up to a constant. Holomorphic isometries, and the setup will be the following. I will be doing things in a more general context, so with general context. It's the following. I will take a D, it's general notation. You can specialize the case of bounded symmetric domain. So these are bounded domains. And I will use ds squared omega, ds squared d for the Bergman matrix. And lambda is a positive real number. And I'm looking at germs of holomorphic isometries. So namely, so this is a germ of map, which preserves the matrix, and I allow a certain constant, and I would call this the isometric constant. Okay. So F is a map which is at the same time holomorphic and isometric. So this is rather, these are rather strong constraints, and they were studied systematically, in a general context, between Kähler manifolds by Calabi. And there was this famous thesis published in 1953, in which a number of new notions were introduced, including the notion of the diastasis. Okay, now, so generally speaking, perhaps I should start with some examples. If you take and you just take the following coordinates and you map this into, so this is the Segre embedding, and from the log 1 plus summation, You get an isometry with respect to the Fubini-Schnoody metric, and if you specialize to the diagonal and then you go to M, then you get Pn going into, or slightly smaller than that, but let's say this is the Veronese embedding, or first Veronese embedding. So this is simply the embedding which is given by sending a vector alpha into alpha tensor alpha. And of course, you can generalize this by taking k copies of them, and then what you get would be the case would be, well, generalized Veronese embedding, and these are isometric embeddings with respect to the Fubini-Schnoody metric with an isometric constant k. Now, then one can raise the question whether you have something in the case of negative curvature. So instead of, so for instance, you can get examples where actually for any Hermitian symmetric space of the compact type, of course, you have an isometric embedding in the project space, and then you can compose and so on. You get many examples, and then you can ask whether something can be worked out for the dual case. Now, the Grassmannian GPQ is simply the dual of G1PQ. So you have the pre-embedding into PN and so on. Now, as it turned out, actually, the situation is quite different in the case of negative curvature. So on the one hand, one expects more rigidity, right? Because negative curvature is usually one expects more rigidity. On the other hand, it turns out that So you look at these examples. Of course, they are not totally geodesic. Only the trivial ones are totally geodesic. But on the other hand, they are equivariant. So these are equivariant. There's a compact Lie group acting behind the scene, and it's invariant or equivariant with respect to that group. So in the case of a negative curvature, it turns out that there are examples which are not equivariant. So which at the beginning was conjectured to be impossible. Actually, there, as I will show you, it's possible to get non-equivariant examples. But let me explain why I got interested in this problem. This was actually arising from a problem in arithmetic geometry, and it's due to Clausel, Ulmo, and it was published in 2003 in Quell. And it's the following. I have to give some context to this. They were interested in omega mod gamma. So let's say finite volume, and let's say for simplicity's sake, where omega is reducible. And they consider what are called Hecker correspondences for the purpose of this lecture. Let me just do it sort of schematically. If you take x here and you take x, Hecker correspondence, well, they let me put this special types of Hecker correspondences. In general, this is also called modular. They arise from what we can call multi-valued automorphisms. So suppose I have an automorphism, and I look at the graph of the automorphism, it's essentially the diagonal. The identity map is an automorphism. Now, there are, however, automorphisms, local automorphisms, which do not extend globally. They extend on some finite cover, and you push it down. And so you have a multi-valued automorphism. They preserve the metric. So you have the projections are unramified coverings. Now, so they were interested, they call this T, the correspondence defined by the graph of a multi-valued automorphism. And they were interested in computing the commutator of T among algebraic correspondences. So what does that mean? An algebraic correspondence is an S, which has the same picture, but simply that this multi-value graph might have singularities. So this is my S lying inside X cross X. And there might be singularities, but if you remove a certain small set, then you still have coupling situation, finite, generically, and so on. And what does it mean to compute the commutator? You take TS equal to ST. Now, when you have two maps, so for instance, it's the graph of a map, then the composition of two graphs is simply the graph of the composition of the maps. When you have an algebraic correspondence, it's something which can be sort of thought of as weighted graph. So then, multi-value maps. So you can compose each branch of the map and put in the correct weight, and therefore it makes sense to compose two correspondences in the obvious way. Okay, so this is just, you ignore the singularities. You do the composition, and then this can be expanded as a subvariety. Okay, so then they compute this, and interesting thing for a complex geometer is the following intermediate result. They say that if I take this algebraic correspondence, which is called by, denoted by S here, and you look at a general point here, a general graph, and look at different branches here, so then you get a map. So let's say this is my x equal to omega mod gamma, but locally speaking, it's simply you take omega and there is a certain base point, and you have then a map f going into omega, let's say y0 raised to the power p. So let's say there are p branches, and the observation is that, or the intermediate result, for some particular types of algebraic of modular correspondences, this can be described group theoretically. It's the following thing: you look at this map, then F is a holomorphic isometry up with respect to Berman metric up to some scaling constant lambda, and lambda is in dimension one cases an integer, but in general this is a real number. Okay, so then it becomes completely a problem in differential geometry, trying to characterize those maps which preserve the Berman metric up to a scaling constant. And then you can raise this question for arbitrary bounded domains. The interest they have, or the result they have, was the following. So first of all, they prove that the important thing is the following statement. So you take T, this particular, so I would just put special. They call it the sum of exterior, the Hecker correspondences. So this special Hecker correspondence, just for the term special is just for this talk. And omega, irreducible, boundless symmetric domain, then let ST equal to TS, so S being a commutator among the algebraic correspondences, then S is the graph of a modular correspondence, that is, S must arise from some other T prime. Under the following assumptions, when one, omega is equal to the disk. So this is the one-dimensional situation. And two, when rank of omega is at least equal to two. Well, does it work? Oh. Very nice. Okay, now, in the second case, actually, this follows from early works of mine, and then later on by Toh. This was 87 and 89, on Hermitian metric rigidity. Let me explain how this follows from there. Or rather, from the argument there. So, it's actually much more general. Suppose I have a map F, a local, let's say omega prime, and this is boundless symmetric domain, and this is an irreducible boundless symmetric domain, of rank. So for instance, given my matrices of rank, p by 2 matrices, when the minimum of P and Q is at least 2. So then you have a picture like this. You have an omega, so you have some base point here, and then you have an isometry. Well, what is the meaning of having higher rank here? Higher rank means actually that there are flats. So in the complex context, it means that there are zeros of bisectional curvature. So zeros of bisectional curvature. So which means that there are non-trivial pairs for which is the curvature is equal to zero. You can actually put in a polydisk and totally geodesically, and for a polydisk, if you have the factors orthogonal to each other, then of course you get zeros of bisectional curvature. And they are flats in the sense that they are complexification of real flats. So all the geometry is actually there. Now, if you have something like this, then you have an isometry, what happens is that you have zeros of bisectional curvature for both omega and omega prime. It's an isometry, so the curvatures are the same. But on the other hand, as subspaces, the curvature is measured by the second fundamental form. And therefore, you get the following. So 0 is equal to r omega, r equal to r omega minus the second fundamental form, sigma alpha. But on the other hand, this is equal to 0, so this is minus sigma alpha zeta norm square. So this implies that sigma alpha zeta is equal to 0. And the algebra done in my first paper actually implies that sigma is identically equal to 0. Okay. So this is the higher rank situation, of course, and that gets me interested to know what happens in the rank one case. So I've been dealing with the rigidity problems on bound symmetric domains and it interests me to see what kind of rigidity results one can have for the rank one case, since the rank one case is very different from the higher rank case. The higher rank case is due to the complexity, so to speak, of the curvature tensor. Now, in the rank one case, so let me say, to give some background, so using methods of Calabi, Umehara, in the 70s, proved the following result. If you take Bn, so holomorphic isometry, then this must be totally geodesic. Okay, he uses the notion of the diastasis. Now, okay, so in some sense, this is more rigid than the project space case. Of course, you can get the Veronese embedding, which are equivariant, but nonetheless, of course, not totally geodesic. So this must be totally geodesic. His results are stronger. Actually, what he proved is the following. If you take Bn, and you take any complex submanifold, and assume that this is Kähler Einstein, then actually, this is already totally geodesic. Now, then you may ask, does this result generalize? Now, in the case of positive curvature, the project space is sort of a universal space. If you want to study the Grassmannian, you embed the Grassmannian into projective space. Okay. Now, in the dual case, the picture is opposite. You cannot embed things into the ball. The ball has negative curvature, and you have monotonicity of bisectional curvature. So for a subspace, you have even more negative curvature. And what I want to drive, one thing I want to point out today is that actually in order to study bound symmetric domain, and in general bound domains, you can still make use of structure of universal spaces, but the universal space is the projective space, the infinite dimensional one. And the idea is the following. If you take a domain D, so how do you get the metric? You get the metric by means of an orthonormal basis. Basis of square integrable holomorphic functions on the domain D, and then you can look at this map P infinity, and the map is simply defined by mapping using an orthonormal basis. The Berman metric is nothing other than the pullback by the Fubini-Studi metric. Because what is the Berman metric? The Berman metric is nothing other than the Taylor form is given by log K, and Berman kernel is simply given by this guy. So K D of Z W is simply given by a summation F I Z F I W. Okay. So that's one thing I want to point out. So in the paper by Clozel Umo, they prove the new case of the disk by means of functional equations or functional identities between potentials, and they prove the following. They prove, so when omegas, they prove one. So the graph of F as a germ, so this is a sub-variety inside, let's say, disk cross extends algebraically as a germ of variety. To actually P1 plus P1 to the power P. So you only have something which is a priori very transcendental, it preserves some metric, and then they prove that actually this is algebraic, extends all the way to CN, actually as affine algebraic varieties. It means the same thing, that it extends to a compact, to the compactification. Okay. And then second, using the group gamma, because they're not, first of all, interested in this, they were interested in x equal to omega, in this case, delta mod gamma, so there's some group lying behind the scene, and it acts in some fashion on the extension. So using gamma, they prove that actually F is totally geodesic. And then they raise the conjecture that actually gamma, the second step is not necessary, in the sense that, so in other words, they conjecture that any germ of holomorphic isometry up to normalizing constant is already totally geodesic. I got interested in this problem mainly due to the fact that the high-dimensional case was not solved. You have the BN case. Okay. So then actually, I work on the BN case, so in the case of BN, n bigger than or equal to 2, and I prove that when this case, actually, the analog of the conjecture is correct. So of course, the general problem is to solve it for all irreducible symmetric domain, therefore the remaining case is the case of the n ball. And where n is bigger than or equal to 2, so the analog is correct of the conjecture for BN, but there is a distinction. In the case of BN, what is needed is Alexander's theorem. Well, I will explain later on how this enters, but the thing is that if you have a map between two, so let's say actually the maps are already, you have extended things. Well, first of all, one proves the extension for high dimensions, and then you have some map which preserves the boundary. This is a holomorphic map. And then it follows from Alexander's theorem that this is a global holomorphism. So this is something about higher dimensional balls. And then I was still under the impression that the conjecture should also be right for the one-dimensional case. So actually at the beginning, there were some proofs which turned out to be, well, by the authors of that article, which turned out to contain a mistake. So I was working in the direction of trying to find a proof by studying the asymptotics of the isometric embedding. So of course, by the first part, they already knew that this extends as global isometry, and then when I studied the asymptotics near the boundary, so that was the approach I adopted. Then after working for some time with the asymptotics, I realized that there was one situation that could lead to an example which is not totally geodesic. And I tried the example, and it turned out that that is indeed a counterexample. Well, for me, of course, the original application was sort of a pretext for me to study a general question of holomorphic isometries between bounded domains, which in the Kähler case, I mean, general for compact Kähler manifolds, there is an underlying theory which was developed by Calabi, and I wish to see how things could be special in the case of Bergmann metrics. Okay, so here is the a very simple example. So although they are very simple, it's also rather difficult to construct holomorphic isometries in general. I will show you some examples, some other examples later on. The simplest example is this. And what is important is that you have to think about that you have a map from the upper half plane, the product of two upper half planes. So of course they're equivalent, and you use the tau variable. And the map is simply this. So this is a holomorphic isometry. So a student of mine actually showed that in case of two dimensions, this is essentially the only map, other than totally geodesic. And also in the, well, yeah. Okay, so how does one verify that? It suffices to verify that the potentials agree. And that's one thing about Kähler metrics. To say that two metrics agree, it suffices to verify that they have the same potentials. And suppose I take square root tau equal to alpha plus I beta, then tau is the square. So this times 2 alpha beta. And the potential of the Plancken metric here is given by log imaginary part of tau. Okay, so then you look at the 2 alpha beta is 2 times, and so this is actually this part is the imaginary part of square root tau, and this is minus imaginary part of I times square root tau. So when you pull it back, so up to a constant, so you get log imaginary part of tau is equal to log imaginary part of square root tau plus log imaginary part of I square root tau, and then plus some constant. So you have agreement of the potentials. When you pull back, of course, you get an isometry. So this is how the first example was constructed, and then you can imagine by analogy, one can have the following map. So P, and you take the following map, tau going into a gamma, the tau gamma square, sorry. So I should have where gamma to the power of p, so this is, well, then I check that this is indeed a holomorphic isometry. The checking actually reduces to something which is not entirely trivial. It is something related to the some functional identity which goes as follows. So the identity is the following. It's a consequence of the following trigonometric identity. So in a way, the trigonometric identity is embedded in the holomorphic isometry. Okay. So let me now explain a general method of dealing with this. It was started by the Clausel-Ummel along the line of making use of potentials as was done in Calabi. And the point is to make use of normal forms. So to explain the picture, you take the case of the disk into. It doesn't matter very much. The important thing is that here you have, you can assume that f of 0 is 0. So this is one normalization. And this normalization, from the point of view of the disks involved, is, of course, at no price. This is homogeneous. You can always move a point to the origin. But when you equate potential, it turns out to be very important for the calculations for the following reason. So what is the potential function in case of the disk? Now here you have to use the disk model. Here, therefore, for example, you have used the upper half plane model. So this is, of course, they are equivalent, but it turns out that they serve very different purposes. Okay. So the potential is actually this. And now when you equate the potentials, this is what you get. You get that log 1 minus z squared is equal to log summation log fi z squared plus the real part of a holomorphic function. The potential, of course, is something particular to a Kalin matrix. So instead of using a matrix equation for the metric, you reduce the case of equating the potentials. So it's a scalar equation. But on the other hand, you don't have uniqueness of the potential. The difference is the real part of a pluriharmonic function in general. And what Calabi did in introducing diastasis is to take care of this indeterminacy by some symmetrizing techniques. So, here it's more elementary. You just look at the potential. Just look at the potential. And you make the normalization f0 equal to 0. And then you expand this. So let's say each one is looks like this aik, z to the power k, and you have k equal to 1 to infinity. So put in this, you expand that. Okay. Now, on the other hand, now you start with k equal to 1, and when you do the expansion, I think this is blocking the way a little bit. So the only thing you see, when you take norm square, you would have terms of this z, let's say zj, let me use an n here. Something like that, where j and k must be both of them bigger than or equal to 1. You have no zero order terms. But on the other hand, when you take the real part of a holomorphic function, you only get h plus h bar. So you only have 0 k type, or you have a k 0 type. So here, of course, this is the same. This is explicit. You don't have anything that looks like the real part of a holomorphic function. The upshot is that actually, although there was a priori some inconsistency, some indeterminacy due to the real part of a holomorphic function, actually that part is zero, just by equating, we're looking at the expansion. Okay. So then one has this function equation, you can exponentiate. Of course, in general, you have something to the power of lambda, but so you have this equation, pi 1 plus fi z squared. equal to 1 minus z squared raised to the power lambda. They were considering the case where lambda is an integer, which is good enough for the problem. Okay. Now, then starting from there, they proved that actually the radius of convergence of the germ is actually at least equal to 1, and then they extend to a global map, and then they prove extension beyond the boundary. Well, one reason why this issue arises as to how to generalize this to high dimensions is that the method doesn't seem to generalize easily to high dimensions. Well, as a complex analyst, I think this would be the most natural thing that a complex analyst would try, trying to make use of such equation. So for simplicity's sake, let's still restrict to the case of the disk, but try to give a method of proof of algebraic extension, which is in a way more systematic. Okay. But before that, let me just say one thing. Actually, already follows from Calabi's work that you have global extension. The question is extension beyond the boundary. Why does one have global extension? Because this trick of considering a manifold as a submanifold of interdimensional projective space. And Calabi's work actually covered the interdimensional case. And it had theorems of analytic continuation and theorems of uniqueness. And from there, you can already know that this embedding, so this germ, which can then be regarded as a germ of map into interdimensional projective space, actually extends. And this extension must already lie in the image from the identity theorem, and therefore you can get extensions. The fact that the radius of convergence is at least 1 follows from Calabi's work, although that was not, the authors were not aware of that. But of course, the most important thing that they solved was that actually you can extend beyond the boundary. So that's the main thing. So the question is, how does one do this extension beyond the boundary in general? Well, first of all, with the higher dimensional ball, and then with arbitrary bounded domains, actually one can even look at manifolds in general. So it's a sort of a rather general problem. Now, I was still interested in the bounded symmetric domains first, in this case, in the case of ball, but the setup can be worked out first of all in the case of circular domains. And then recently I was able to generalize to the most general domains that one can consider. So you can take actually arbitrary amount of domains. And for this, I obtained interior results. As I said, some of that already follow from Calabi, but in the case of Berman metrics, I could do more generally. So let's say I can write down the general results. So if you take D and omega to be arbitrary bounded domains, no pseudo convexity whatsoever, but actually I put in some conditions on the metric. These conditions are not absolutely necessary, but to formulate the better results, I will write in this way. So exactly the same setup, but this doesn't need to be a product, just any germ of maps between the bounded domains. The interior result is the following. Suppose that they are complete as a Berman metric. So the domain equipped with the Berman metric is a complete Taylor manifold. Then I can have the neater formulation as follows. Then F extends to a proper holomorphic isometric embedding. Okay. So this is arbitrary domains, but you have the Berman metric. You assume that the Berman metrics are complete. If you don't make the assumption, it's still true that the germ can extend. The germ of the graph can extend.
You put any assumptions
in the boundary. No, this is interior result, just for interior results. Okay. Then you put something on the boundary and you get boundary results, and the boundary condition is the following. So boundary result. So suppose KD extends real analytically. So this is the Berman kernel to, let's say, D bar. D equals D bar. And it's the neighborhood. So actually you take the closure and you take away the diagonal and you assume extension, same for omega, which is the case for balanced numerical domain, for instance, in the case of a ball, KD is that W is simply 1 over minus Z dot W bar as factors, and then you raise this to a certain power. So these are rational functions. So what is needed is actually simply that the Berman kernel is some extension property, then F, then the graph of F extends beyond the boundary. So you have, first of all, you have, so this one is the recent improvement of what was done in
you put no assumption to the boundary of the domain.
No, I didn't put any assumption. Right, I only put the assumption on the Berman kernel. So for instance, it can work on circular domains without assuming that the boundary is has any regularity. Of course, to get examples where these properties are verified, usually you get this property is not so easy to verify in general. So, but even if you have real analytic boundary, you don't know very much. So you know the C-infinity type of expansion, and one can formulate a similar problem in the C-infinity category. But for the time being, I only work in the real analytic category. So of course, you look at the Berman metric. This is the case of Bohr, and in the case of the balanced numerical domain of type 1, what you get is 1 over determinant I minus Z bar transpose, and that's raised to a certain power, so you still get some rational function. Or on the other hand, the boundary is rather rugged. Actually, this is piecewise algebraic, so this is a different notion of regularity. It's the regularity of the Berman kernel. Now, okay. So let me explain the simple case where you have this into. Okay, so actually the same argument will work in the case of Bn. So let me just explain in the simpler notations. So here is the case of a disk. And then you look at the functional equation. The functional equation is one which is real analytic. So you take 1 minus, did I erase that? It's there. Okay, well, at least up to the boundary, let me put it this way. Okay, so let's take lambda an integer to simplify. Then you have algebraic equations, except that F is a priori transcendental. Now, then as a complex analyst, you look at a real analytic identity, you can always complexify it. So this, I may call this polarization. That is what you do. In general, so in the study of sacred varieties and so on, so you have the following a functional identity, so pi now, then I can allow lambda to be any real number. I only consider these identities where W is small, arbitrarily small. So I get an equation which is defined even outside. When W is very small, this is still, of course, defined. Okay. All right. And then this satisfies the equation, but you can look at this. functional identity. So you, zeta is now the a new set of variables. And the functional identity tells you that the special case where zeta I is equal to f I z actually satisfies this system, this infinite dimension, but infinite number of holomorphic identities. Yeah. Now, then the question is, are there other solutions? Because you don't need to know that there are no other solutions. You only need to know that nearby there are no other solutions. If that is the case, then you can take the extension to be simply the common solution set of this system of holomorphic identities. And that's it. Now, then the question is whether you can have nearby solutions, so you can think about what are the possibilities, and from the functional identities, it's by some elementary arguments using elementary symmetric polynomials, one can prove the following thing, that zeta in norm can be bounded in terms of z. So suppose I have another solution here, somewhere else, I can a priori, by making use of the explicit function equation, show that actually they are bounded, bounded as a function of z. And the upshot is that, of course, then you have finite fibers. So I'm defining something like this. I can take VW, so the solution set gives me VW, so lying over the disk, well, actually over the complex plane. And then you define V to be the intersection of VW, and neighborhood, arbitrarily small neighborhood of zero. So this is a variety. Now, so this one needs to prove that fibers are finite. In this case, then you can just take V to be the extension of graph F. And this a priori estimate then implies, well, that the fibers are finite due to the maximum principle. Okay. If you have positive dimensional fibers, it must go to infinity. So that's good enough. And this one can apply to the case of the ball. Now, as it turns out, this is in general not true. So if I take bounded domains, even in the case where things are known, if you take a ball, Bn going into Bn, the z going into z0, if you take this map and you use this approach, it turns out to be this a priori bound of the fibers turns out to be false. It's very easy to write down what they are. In this case, they are linear subspaces. So what I did, first of all, with the case, so what I did in the case of well, in the general case, but let me explain things under the assumption that D contains origin, 0 contains omega, F0 is 0, and these are circular domains. So if I make this assumption, then actually you have more or less the same type of phenomenon, and you end up with the following identity. So this is the following K omega. So F is a germ from D0 to omega 0. And then you have K the original function identity is the following. It's equal to same thing, and then you polarize and look at it. So for each W, you can look at this identity. There's some constant here. So okay, and the statement is that the graph of F still expands. And how does one solve the difficulty with the deformation? Well, what one does is actually to assume that there are deformation and look at what happens. So suppose I have a graph here, and I have, so So this is actually graph of F. And then I look at nearby. If I choose a good enough point, then I can get a family. As a family, things might still fold up, but I still get a map. So I can look at infinitesimal deformation. So this is what I want to look at, the infinitesimal deformation. Now, so you can look at the identity and put in FTZ here. Now, so you make use of this identity, and then you differentiate against T to a certain number of times until some infinitesimal deformation of higher order appears. It must appear somewhere. So then you differentiate against T L times. And then you end up with an identity which goes as follows. And let me choose an orthonormal basis, so Hn is an orthonormal basis. For H2 omega, and the differentiation on the right-hand side, this has nothing to do with T, so when you differentiate, you get zero, and you just compute the infinitesimal deformation of the Lth order, and you end up with this identity, this summation, d Hn at eta Hn. So this is the identity. So what's eta? Eta is this derivative. So let me just call this eta. Okay. So you have this thing, and you have sort of a vector field along this this graph, and then the infinitesimal deformation gives you this identity. Now, one thing about the Berman kernel is that when you do computations, you can make use of any orthonormal basis. And it turns out that if you look at that, there's a very good choice. So suppose I fix a point at zero and I want to look at this type of identity, then I can make use, so this is in general, but I take z0 as a base point, and I choose my orthonormal basis with the following property. So this is what Berman did. So if you take a domain, you take a point, and the so-called representative domains, you start with maximizing the value of the function, and then you look at the orthogonal complement, and then you maximize derivative in various directions, and then you maximize second derivatives, and so on and so forth. So in so doing, here you will have only two terms that enter into the picture. So you have H0, which maximizes, so this is essentially given by K Z0, essentially given by that is the up to a constant, and this is the H0 term. For the H1, I choose the one that maximizes in the direction of this vector field. Okay, then for the other holomorphic functions Hn, n bigger than or equal to 2, actually dHn is going to be equal to 0. So then you have a linear equation in infinite dimensional space, which contains only two terms. And then you do a number of algebraic, simple algebraic manipulations, and it turns out that this forces the following to be true. It forces the image to lie in the zero set of an extremal function. The extremal function here is H1. H1 is the one that maximizes the derivative in the in the eta direction. So for each z0, you can now get a certain holomorphic function, which is, let me call this h1, but this depends on z0. And this is an extremal function. And for extremal functions, they are as nice as the Berman kernel, because you can take the Berman kernel and differentiate to get the extremal functions. So for instance, if I have a Berman kernel that extends algebraically, then I have essentially something like that for h1. And for each one of that, for each point here, I can get such an extremal function. And now the statement is that the graph actually lies in the common zero set, or the image lies in the common zero set of the extremal functions defined by points along the curve. And when you have a very good Berman kernel, then the intersection of these zero sets remain algebraic. So originally, you might have deformation. Now I impose additional assumptions, and the additional assumption is that I can assume that the F, so there's a certain variety which is obtained by taking the V, an intersection of the zero set of these extremal functions, and they are also algebraic. These are also defined by Berman kernel, so I get something algebraic in the case of non-symmetric domains. And then E would be an extension of my original germ. Now, this kind of argument actually also works for bound domains in general. The assumption that I use, circular domain assumption, was simply to look at the normal form. But actually, if you use the embedding by making use of these representative domains, you still get the same vanishing of the real part of holomorphic functions. It suffices to take the maps which are given by H1, which maximizes H1, and so on. And you check that, and you get an identity which is similar, except that you have to put in the, some additional terms. Perhaps it suffices for me to just write down the holomorphic identities there, and it goes as follows. It's just a generalization of the argument I just had. Okay. The identity is the following. X0 is a base point. Okay. So you check that the argument of the disappearance of the real part of a holomorphic function still works if you choose the proper coordinates. Okay. Now, then you might worry about this raising the power lambda. Now, in the case of circular domains, at the origin, you actually get a constant. The extremal function is actually, the k, zero something, is actually a constant. But so you look at it here, and you might worry about this power lambda. If I take common zero set, am I going to get something well-defined? But actually, if you evaluate a center, you still get a trivial identity. And if I have a family of identities starting with a trivial one, I can differentiate in the parameter to get new identities which are equivalent to the original one. And this identity, of course, comes from taking log. Originally it was log, right? And then I just exponentiate to look it nicer, to make it look nicer. So actually you have logarithm, and you differentiate in the parameters, the logarithm disappears. So although originally there were some logarithms, you can differentiate to get rid of the logarithm. You can do that if you start from a trivial identity. When you differentiate, of course, you lose the initial identity. But if the initial identity is trivial, you can forget about it. Okay. And then you get, again, the rational identities if your k's are rational. So finally, let me just say that in the case, for examples, other than the Berman, the piece root map, that is by taking the piece root of tau, I actually constructed some other examples, and examples looks like this. Suffices to say that it is not so easy just to construct even one single example of a holomorphic isometry, And so I don't have too many at this point other than the PIF map. So here's one example. So this is a map of the disk going into six dimensional, so D166 actually into the symmetric part, and it looks like this. So there are still roots. So this is the first part, and if I call this H of zeta, I have something which is H minus zeta. So it gets into something like a product of bound symmetric domains, and I check that this is a holomorphic isometry. Now, actually, I study the asymptotics of the holomorphic isometries. I can prove that, in general, if you look at the norm of the second fundamental form, this is going to vanish at infinity at a general point. So it means that it's the generic, this is an asymptotically total geodesic map. And then there are vanishing orders of this, and I can prove that the vanishing order is either 1 or 2. In the case of polydisc, the vanishing order is 2. In the case of this example, my belief is that it's of order 1. I was doing some calculations yesterday, and after the dinner, so it appeared that is the case, but I have to check every detail. Okay, thank you.